As you write your life story, you're far from finished. Are you looking to close the book on your job? Maybe turn a page in your career? Be continued at the Georgetown University School of Continuing Studies. Our professional master's degrees and certificates are designed to meet you where you are and take you where you want to go. At Georgetown SCS, the learning never stops, and neither do you. Write your next chapter. Be continued at scs.georgetown.edu/podcast.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Hi, I'm Wendy.
And I'm Jess, and you're listening to the Food Heaven Podcast,
your online resource for inclusive and accessible wellness.
Hey everyone, hope you guys are all holding up okay with everything that's going on. How have you been doing, Wendy?
I'm doing okay. I'm really excited about today's episode because I think it's really going to resonate with a lot of our listeners. I mean, we already recorded and I'm just thinking back on everything that we covered. I learned so, so much from our guests. And yeah, I'm just really happy that we're diving into this topic.
So the topic, as you probably saw, is death and grief. We're going to be talking with my BFF, my best friend, Ashley. She is a registered nurse based in California. She has experience in public health. She's also been a champion for palliative care, which we'll talk about what exactly that is. She breaks it all down. And those end-of-life discussions that can be really complex to have with our loved ones, even if someone isn't actively dying, like having those conversations beforehand, we realize there's a lot that we don't know about our close family members in terms of how they would want their death to be handled, how they'd want the dying process handled. And the reason we also really wanted to talk with Ashley is because she is still dealing with the loss of her mother. That was 18 months ago. And so she has like this not only professional experience with all of this, but also a personal connection with death, dying, and grieving as well.
So in this episode, we're going to talk about Ashley's experience with death and grief. We're also going to talk about practical things that we can all do to better prepare us for these experiences. As Jess mentioned, we're also going to talk about palliative care and what the difference is between palliative, hospice, and dying at home. And Ashley's also going to share some of the ways that she was able to preserve her mother's memory. And a lot of these things didn't even come to mind that I could do. And so I think this information is going to be really, really helpful. So with that being said, let's jump right in.
So we're super excited to have you on the podcast. Ashley is my best friend, and I'm thrilled that she agreed to have this conversation with us. That is something that people don't really talk about as much, and that is the topic of death and grief. And we felt like this was a good time to talk about this, especially amidst everything that's been happening with COVID-19 and having a lot of friends, parents, or siblings, or even like my brother-in-law. He has a good friend who is in a coma from COVID-19, who's like in his mid-30s. And so I think just having this conversation about death and grief is really important, especially amidst everything that's going on right now. So welcome to the podcast, Ashley.
Thank you for having me, guys.
How are you doing over there, Ash?
Oh, it's just such weird times. It's a weird time to be alive. It's a weird time to be a nurse. Every day is weird. I'm so happy to be able to talk about something that I know a lot about and get to share it with you guys and your listeners just in the middle of this crazy time we're having.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you. And like Jess said, this is very timely. Everyone has experience with death, but especially now, it's like it almost seems like it's everywhere. And so I think a good place to start would be with you sharing your experiences with death, if you want to get personal or if you want to talk about your experiences with death as a nurse or both.
Well, I'm an only child and I was raised by a single mom who her parents died when she was Her dad died when she was 10 months old and her mom died when she was 6. So she grew up in the system. You know, her and her siblings were wards of the state and death was just such a huge part of her upbringing. And I think for her, it was always death and dying was always in the back of her mind. So when I was a little kid, we had conversations about, you know, if mommy died, I would go live with my auntie and what would happen to my toys and my friends. You know, we talked about death in that way because it was a reality for her. And then when I was in the 10th grade, I was 15, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and her potential death became really real. And it was, you know, in our face. And we started really talking about death and preparing for death in a lot of ways at that time. And she didn't end up dying from breast cancer for another 20 years, but her experience with cancer and just multiple occurrences and stages and surgeries and treatments and hospitalizations really influenced me to become a nurse and to advocate for her and for others who are just facing our massive, complicated healthcare system. So in my personal life, I experienced death in that way. And in my professional life, you know, I've worked on palliative care initiatives. I taught a community health nursing class with a focus on death and dying. So I feel like I have a lot of experience in talking about it and dealing with it, but I feel like we could all do more. I could do more. And even when my mom died, I still don't feel like I was prepared for that experience.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on that, just like preparation, because I can't even imagine having to go through that over and over again, like with mm-hmm. your mom being, you said she was diagnosed more than once with breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I could only imagine like how difficult that is. And I'm wondering, like, how do you prepare? Do you feel like as you've gotten older and you've had all of these experiences and also working within this field, do you feel like you're better prepared to experience death or not really?
No. Still no.
Yeah.
You know, so even with all of that experience, I don't feel prepared. I don't, you know, every time. So the first diagnosis, I think it was like stage 2 or stage 3, and you know, she beat it and we kind of moved on, and then it came back, and then she beat that one, and then it came back, and then it was really just a part of our life. And my mom had breast cancer for 19 years and she died when I was 34. So the majority of my experience as her daughter, cancer was a part of our lives. And we did, you know, we talked about it, but it's still, even at the end, I was not prepared for everything that came with losing her.
Yeah, I feel like it's just so, I mean, just from what you're saying, it sounds like that's just the definition of trauma, basically,
yeah.
Especially being, you know, like you said, so young, and then having to be something that you've experienced like pretty much for the last couple of decades. And we have talked about, like, I feel like we have a friendship where we kind of talk about like death or the idea that like we're all gonna die. And I think maybe that's part of working as a healthcare provider as well, because especially if you've worked in a hospital and you've had like your patients die like in a hospital or even outpatient, where you have patients you're working with and then, you know, they end up dying and you kind of see it in the notes, like maybe you have an appointment scheduled with them and they don't show up, and you kind of can go through some of the notes and see like what happened. So I feel like it's something that we're a little bit more, I don't want to say experienced with, but introduced to maybe. And I remember taking this class. It was right after high school. It was between like high school and college. It was a class of psychology of death and dying. And this was like the first time before like working in the hospital system where I started thinking about it like, whoa, wait, we're all gonna die. Like, why is this something that nobody talks about? Why is this something that makes everybody so uncomfortable? We watched like all these different videos of people who were dying and kind of like their last words and their relationships with like their family members and kind of how that all played out. It felt like outside of that class and also in adult life, like nobody really wants to talk about death at all, even though it's the only thing that we're all going to experience. And I'm curious, like from someone who has worked as a nurse within the setting and also who's experienced the death of a parent, like why do you think this is something that's so hard to talk about?
I just think Americans, and I can only speak to our culture, we don't like to talk about death because we are all focused, maybe not all of us, but our culture is so focused on win, you know, outlast, be number one, be the best. And, you know, where does death fit into that?
Right. Have any of you guys ever been to the ER or the hospital and had to be hooked up for an IV because you were dehydrated and had the experience of going from being dehydrated to rehydrated and kind of the feeling that you get from that, which is one of the most amazing feelings I've ever experienced in my life. That's what it feels like to drink one of the hydration packs that our podcast sponsor this week makes. So if you were listening to the podcast episode a couple weeks ago where we talked with the hydration expert, Whitley Atkins, about some of the myths and the actual facts surrounding hydration, you'll know that so many of us are walking around chronically dehydrated without even knowing it. I was able to realize that I was probably one of those people. Like, I thought that that feeling was reserved to getting hydrated from an IV, not something that I could experience in everyday life. So flash forward to when I tried one of the Hydrant electrolyte packs that our podcast sponsor makes. I mixed it with water. I had it in the morning. Like, I think I was reading as part of my morning routine. And I told my husband after I drank it, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. This feels crazy. This feels like how I feel like when I get an IV in the hospital. This has to be a joke. I've been taking them every day ever since. I actually subscribed to Hydrant with my own money. So now I'm going to get the monthly subscription that I'll talk about. But hands down, if you feel like you're someone who isn't always fully hydrated or you want to feel a little better, or sometimes you suffer from dehydration, I highly recommend this product. So what is Hydrant? They create flavored electrolyte packets you mix directly into your water to make hydrating your body easy and delicious. Each rapid hydration mix has the four essential electrolytes your body needs, sodium, potassium, magnesium, and zinc, to help you hydrate quickly and stay hydrated all day. And the great thing is Hydrant is backed by research. The formula was developed by Oxford scientists to provide perfectly balanced, efficient hydration. There's no synthetic colors or artificial flavors. The formula is vegan, and you can choose between three flavors or a variety pack. My personal favorite, actually, I like all of them, but the ones that we subscribe to, because my husband also got a subscription, are the lime and the blood orange. Hydrant starts at just $1 a pack for a 30-day supply, and you can save even more with a monthly subscription. And for 25% off your first order, go to drinkhydrant.com and enter the promo code FOODHEAVEN at checkout. I actually did this to get 25% off. The code does work, you guys. That's drinkhydrant.com and enter the promo code FOODHEAVEN for 25% off your first order. Drinkhydrant.com and enter the code Food Heaven. All right, now let's move on to the episode.
I feel like people see death as a failure. You know, people, you know, they'll ask me like, oh, your mom has cancer. And they would follow it up with like, oh, well, did she smoke? Or, you know, they're trying to rationalize their own mortality in their own place. We have so many organizations and events that are focused on surviving cancer and championing it. And we admire in our culture people who have beat serious illness. Like, we write stories about them. There's movies about them, right? We love those stories. They right. feel good, but there's not much support or appreciation for those who have quote unquote lost the battle. And there's not a lot of pride or celebration in just life in general, regardless of illness or disability. And I don't know why. I mean, I do know why, but that just seems to be the case here in our country. And it just doesn't leave a lot of space for anything else.
Just thinking about my experience going to funerals in the Dominican Republic, and it really is like, it's a whole situation. Like, we have professional grievers who are like screaming, and it's like literally, I mean, it's a lot. Not saying that that is the superior way, but it's just so different. Kind of like the process of grief and death that I've experienced in other countries and in my culture as well. So I love that you said that, because I do think that in the United States, death and grieving is what we do here doesn't really align with like how the rest of the world, especially I think cultures from that African diaspora, how they process death. Because I know in countries in Africa, in some countries in Africa, they also have like people who are placed at funerals to just cry and like express emotion. And that's just very much part of the tradition. And we do that in the DR as well.
Well, first I thought of Sex and the City and Samantha when she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I can't remember if this was a conversation that she was having in some of the survivors groups, just about how it's very like hush, hush, the people who don't survive. I don't know if it was that, but I also was reading a book, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, on the psychology of positivity and how it's basically all BS and manufactured by companies to help keep us in check. But anyway, that's a whole nother thing. They were talking about like the whole breast cancer survivor thing as well. And just like, how it can be very hush-hush or very, yeah, just like you don't want to touch on the people who didn't quote unquote survive, as if there's something that is like inherently like wrong with not surviving breast cancer. So I'm happy that you mentioned that. And also, yeah, Wendy, what you're saying about it is so different in the United States, I can only imagine, like versus other countries. I remember when I was working at a hospital, I think my first hospital job, and I was doing rounds in the ICU with one of the attendings there, and he was from India. And I'll never forget, he was just kind of commenting like, wow, look at all these patients who were like on ventilators that were just keeping alive. And he was saying like, he gave kind of just like a lecture on how this is completely different, like the way the US approaches this versus how this is approached in other parts of the world. And I'm curious, Ash, like, do you have any thoughts on why you think like the US, it's like by any means necessary, even if someone's completely miserable, like keep them alive on a ventilator, anything we can do, even though the quality of their life may not be very good, they may be actually in a lot of pain. Like, I'm curious on your thoughts about that.
I mean, the short answer is money and capitalism. You know, we could talk about that forever, but, you know, having money means you have access to services and the potential for curative treatment. Before insurance companies and hospitals, death happened in the home, just like birth. Although back then people died much younger and the cause of death in like the 1900s was mostly communicable and infectious disease like TB or influenza. But, you know, people that were providing care when people were dying were the family. And death is normal. It's not something that requires medical intervention. But this changed with healthcare institutions becoming more prevalent. People started living longer, and now more people die from chronic illness than acute disease. And I think this is also the case in America as opposed to other countries too. Like, people have insurance, and so they're, and not everyone has insurance, but people have access to healthcare throughout their lifespan so they can live longer. But now we see most people dying in hospitals rather than at home. And then the length of time that they are dying, actively dying, is prolonged. Despite the fact that 60 million people die annually in the world, 90% of those deaths are from chronic or terminal illnesses. And most people die after like really long, debilitating chronic illness like cancer or lung disease or heart disease. But I think what's most striking about what you were just saying and about the way death is in America is that a lot of people, like 500,000 people, die in ICUs every year. And 60% of deaths that occur in the hospital happen in the ICU. And, you know, I love the ICU. Thank God for the ICU. But it's the place that's like most fictionalized on TV and in movies. It's where that energy of American culture of like perseverance and the person who wakes up after weeks of, you know, being unconscious and their family's at the side and, you know, they're talking. And it's like the majority of people in ICUs today, right now in America, are not going to survive. And we have amazing technology, but we all need to understand that this technology, it can prolong life, but it doesn't restore it. The three of us have probably seen what ICUs really look like because we're healthcare workers. But, you know, I don't think people understand when you run a code on a patient, we break their ribs, we cut their throats open, we shove tubes down their throats for intubation, we start IVs. It's just not a great way to experience the end of life. And I feel like we do it for far more patients than will actually survive and live the way they want to live afterwards. You know, there's just such a huge disparity between the way people die and the way they want to die. And little attention is paid to the psychological needs of people when they're in the hospital at the end of their life. And I think this is mostly driven by money. Like right now, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, there's no visitors allowed in the ICU. So anyone that's in the ICU is going to die alone if they're going to die, which is horrible. And I would encourage everybody who has never really been to a true ICU to check out this documentary on Netflix called Extremis. It's like 25 minutes long, and it gives a really candid and somewhat frightening look at the end of life experience at Highland Hospital in Oakland. And it's an excellent film.
I just watched it. It's so good. That's what I was gonna comment. Like, if anyone hasn't seen this, because she had recommended it before the call, it's exactly what working in an ICU is like. Yeah, especially if you're not used to being in that setting and some of the hard decisions that have to be made. And also the thing that I feel like it did a good job of portraying is there's no easy decision that feels right. You know what I mean? Like, they don't have the answers where it's like, if we do this, we know for sure that this person is going to live. They don't really know. They're like, we could take out the breathing tube and she could maybe, you know, last for a day, or she may spontaneously recover and be fine. Like, we really have no idea of knowing. And so it's just like the family members. And also sometimes, like, there was one patient who had no family whatsoever. They didn't really have a true sense of like his medical history, and he wasn't really able to be a good historian and like person who could tell them what he wanted. So then they had like ethics people in there, which I've seen a lot too, where it's like, this is not ethical, or this is ethical, or this person can't make decisions for themselves. And I just think people don't really understand that's how it works. So I'm so glad you shared that.
Yeah. And I'm thinking now, I'm getting like flashbacks to my clinical rotation with the ICU. I'm like, oh my God, I did not enjoy it. That was my least favorite. I was just like, what is going on over here? It just seemed like the healthcare workers that were there were just very, I'm just like, someone is literally like unconscious. They've been in this bed for God knows how long. It was just like, I don't know. The ICU was just like not a very pleasant experience. And I'm definitely going to check out that documentary. So earlier you mentioned that you have experience with palliative care. So for people who aren't in healthcare, can you talk to us about the difference between palliative care, hospice care? You mentioned dying at home. Like, how are those three things different?
Palliative care is a medical subspecialty that's focused on preventing, treating, and relieving all of the stuff that comes with serious or chronic illness, such as pain. But the unique part about palliative care is that it's not dependent on prognosis or the outcome. So you can have an acute illness that you plan to recover from, but the period of time that you're experiencing hardship, palliative care can provide support. It's also for someone who has a terminal illness or is expected to die from their illness, like cancer or something like that. And the goal of palliative care is to improve the quality of life for patients and their family. So it kind of goes back to that earlier model of including the family in the end of life care plan. Before palliative care models, someone would find out they're ill. We would treat, realize the treatments have failed, and be like, okay, it's time for hospice, and send them to a facility where they would go to die. But this, you know, this might happen like 2 weeks before they actually die. And there's not enough time to figure out what's important to the patient, maybe to prepare the family. It's kind of like, okay, we'll treat you and now it's not working, so we're just going to send you to this facility to die. So palliative care is a much longer trajectory, and we can start talking about what's important before we get to the place where we know death is inevitable. And then hospice is focused on comfort, and it's usually prescribed for someone who has less than 6 months to live. And in short, all things hospice are palliative, but not all things palliative are hospice. So my mom was started on palliative care about 18 months before she died, and she was still doing curative treatments at the time. So she was still doing radiation and taking medication to stop the cancer from spreading. I got married while she was on palliative care. Palliative care kind of treated us as a unit and gave attention to what we're missing in the hospital setting. They asked her what was important to her. They provided education and support to both of us. We took classes, we got therapy, but really they listened to her and respected her wishes. My mom decided not to do chemo treatment at the end of her life. She was over it. She wanted to have her hair. She didn't want to be throwing up. She wanted to still look cute and go out. And she shared this with her oncologist, who was deeply disappointed that she didn't want to try some experimental treatments and treatments that were in clinical trial. Whereas her palliative care doctor was like, absolutely, I get that. And let's make that happen. So that's kind of like a summary of the difference between the two. And hospice in the past was always a facility, but now you can have a hospice nurse that comes to your house so that you can die at home. And that is what we chose to do.
Thank you for that breakdown, because I feel like I was always, until I was able to see through your experience with your mom, I really didn't understand the difference between palliative care and hospice. So I feel like that was a really good breakdown, so people can understand that, yeah, palliative doesn't always mean that you're 2 weeks away from dying or something.
Right.
It can just be to make you feel more comfortable. Now, I want to ask you, and feel free to be like, I don't want to talk about that, and we'll edit this out. But I wanted to ask you about, because we had had conversations about just like the experience of your mom dying and you being there and it being like in her bed and at home, and you kind of saying like it wasn't as, I don't know, like people might think it's like gross or creepy, but it wasn't that at all for you. Do you mind like sharing a little bit about what that experience was like?
No, not at all. I mean, so my mom, like I mentioned, her mom died when she was 6 years old, and she, to the end of her life, could describe perfectly watching her walk into Alta Bates Hospital in Berkeley and waiting for her to go to the fourth floor and wave down to her and her brothers and sisters. And that was the last time she saw her mom. So for my mom, she really thought she was supposed to die in a hospital. And I think she thought it would be easier on me, that maybe it would be gross, or like taking care of her at the end of life. And palliative care really opened the doors for us to talk about her dying at home. And I could just see how relieved she was at this idea that she could be at home with all her things and use her own bathroom and eat her own food. And so when it got to the point where we needed her to start hospice, it was just such an easy transition. And, you know, we had a nurse that came to the house and helped my mom focus on her goals and provided, you know, medication and support. And she was awesome. She was a British nurse, so she just had like a totally different feeling about the American healthcare system and was super supportive of all our weird ideas. You know, she would come and meet with my mom and, you know, notice she's having some difficulty walking and bring a walker to the next visit. Or, you know, she can't hold her body up as well on the walker, so she'd bring a wheelchair to the next visit. And when she was having some difficulty breathing, she was calling the pulmonary clinic at Kaiser and asking them to get her in for a treatment or getting us oxygen. And when she really started to fade away, she got us a hospital bed. And when my mom died, I called her that night and she came over and helped me arrange for her body to be transported to the funeral home. You know, she called and checked in on me afterwards to provide bereavement. She came by just to give me a hug. So my overall experience with hospice was great. And as far as my mom's death, it was, maybe this sounds weird to say, but it was one of the best experiences of my life. And, you know, they had given me this book. It's called Gone From My Sight. It's this little blue book. Anyone who's dealt with hospice will know it. It's famous. And it's got a poem in it. And it breaks down like months before this may happen, weeks before this may happen. And literally everything in that book happened. So I felt really prepared. I read that book like every day. I put it on the coffee table for other people to see when they came to visit. Most people didn't read it, but it really helped me know what to expect. And then in terms of the night that she died, the hospice nurse came by that day. She was experienced. So she was like, I think she's going to go in the next 24 to 48 hours. It was a Friday. So she was trying to prepare me for the weekend without support. And she was spot on. Everything she told me happened. You know, my mom called for me. I went in the room. I held her. The nurse had told me, because she had gotten to know my mom over the last like 7 months, she was like, she's going to have a hard time letting go. So be prepared for her to fight till the end, like give her space, you know, set her up. We put music on. We put all of the things that she liked around her. We put her own sheets on this ugly hospital bed. And I just climbed in there with her and held her until she took her last breath. And it was such a moment of control and just love, because at the end of her life, this horrible experience that I had prepared for, I was able to give her what she wanted. I knew what she wanted. I knew how she wanted things to go. And really all she wanted was for us to be together, and we were. And it was not gross and not weird. And I, you know, her body was in our house for a while afterwards. That also wasn't gross or weird. It was really great. It was an experience of a lifetime.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing that you had that experience. And because I think for a lot of people, like just thinking about that experience, especially like experiencing that for a parent, it's like just traumatizing, even like visualizing what that would look like. And it sounds like you had a really great team on your side that was helping to guide you through all of this. And so that's kind of reassuring to hear that there is another experience. I think also that kind of ties in with like preparation and trying to have the right people by your side, especially like healthcare workers that you feel are supporting you and that are really going to be there for you. I think both emotionally and also practically speaking. And just like the idea of coping with the emotion, for me, it's very overwhelming. And I kind of always just push it to the side anytime that the thought of death comes up in my head, which is quite often, especially I think as we're getting older, our parents are getting older. It's something that I think about a lot. And I don't really engage with it on the emotional front, but on the practical front, I do, because I just don't want it to be a crap show. Like when my parents do pass and I'm just like completely paralyzed, not knowing like what are some of the practical things that need to get done. And so I'm wondering, like, as a nurse, have you noticed that there are things that are oftentimes overlooked in terms of like practical things, like whether it's like legal paperwork or just like things that have to get done in the home? Like, what are some things that you see that people oftentimes don't think about?
I think one of the most important things that everyone should have, whether you're older or you're sick or not, is an advance directive. And basically, an advance directive is a document that outlines what you feel life is and what you feel life isn't. For me, if I can't communicate with my loved ones, I don't want to be alive. And for someone else, it might be, no matter what, I want a full code, everything, tubes, compressions, the whole nine yards, no matter what. And the nice part about an advance directive is that for a loved one, they won't have to make that decision. You don't have to call in the ethics committee. You don't have to guess. You'll know exactly what somebody wants. So I think if everyone can research their state's advance directive process and get that started, it's so important. And I referred to my mom's advance directive so many times at the end of her life, and hers had details as far as like when she didn't want to see people any longer, which was helpful with, you know, family and friends who really just wanted to come over. I had this document that we had discussed and I knew what her wishes were. And then also there's a card game to kind of get that conversation started called Go Wish. I mean, I can give you guys the info about how to get it, but it's just like Go Fish, and it's got statements on it about, you know, what's important to you at the end of your life, like having friends and family around, being clean, knowing exactly what the treatments are, not being in a hospital or being in a hospital. It's just a way to start that conversation. So I think as far as healthcare goes, the advance directive kind of covers everything. There's also some other documents. One's called a PULSE. It's like a physician order for life-sustaining treatment that people can have filled out by their doctor. You can also have a durable power of attorney. So you guys can look those things up, but an advance directive kind of covers them all. And it's a good idea to bring an advance directive with you anytime you go to the hospital, and to also have your primary care doctor have a copy of it, and to have a copy somewhere in your house where many people know where to access it in case of an emergency.
I'm like, I'm doing that today. Got to add it to the to-do list.
That's a really good idea. And it makes me think too, like, wait a minute, I don't have any of this. Like with Yosef, I have no idea. I'm just like, with my mom, I don't know. Like I've told my family I do want to be buried in Piedmont Cemetery, for the record, because that's my favorite. Yes, right? We need to have, oh my God, we need to be like right next to each other. It's the best cemetery. Oh my God.
It's great.
It's like just beautiful vibes. I said I wanted to have my wedding there. Cemetery. Yeah, exactly. Yes. So Ash, for someone who is grieving, I'm just curious, are there any things that you have found particularly helpful for yourself in like going through the process?
Yeah. I mean, since we had a little bit of time, you know, to think about it. And not everyone will have this time, but my mom started, food was such a big part of our relationship. You know, we spent most of our time cooking together or talking about food or eating food. In the last few years of her life, pretty much any recipe that she made and I liked or my husband liked, she would print it out and put it in this binder along with like photocopies of recipes from her actual cookbooks or clippings from the newspaper. Because for her, her mom's cooking was something that she just really missed growing up. So she wanted to make sure that I could recreate a lot of recipes that she had cooked for me in my life with her. So I have this huge binder of all these recipes, some little stories or just little clippings that I really love. And I recently unpacked it and started going through it. And even just seeing her handwriting, really amazing. And knowing that I can cook something almost as good as her brought me some peace. Also, after she died, I preserved her voicemail greeting. There's like this website called Voicemail Save, and you can use it to dial someone's voicemail and it will create like an audio clipping of their outgoing voicemail greeting. So you kind of always have a snipping of their voice. So then this is something that can happen at any time, even for someone who dies suddenly. And then I also use Google to save her phone number that she had for like 35 years. I just couldn't live with this idea that I would accidentally call her number and some random person would show up. I think it's called parking the phone number. People can do this. I think in total, it cost me like $20 to preserve her phone number. That really helped. And then at the end of her life, we went through a lot of photo albums and, you know, did puzzles. And I would just turn the voice memo on my phone on and just record us talking casually. And sometimes when I'm feeling really sad, I just play those random conversations and it just makes me feel so much better just hearing her voice and her laugh and the silly things we were talking about. So those are just a few things that I did to kind of extend her life in a way. And it's great to have all of those items.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. I think that's like such a good idea. And those are things that I would never even think about preserving, especially like, because yeah, when you showed me the recipe book, I was like, this is so genius, so thoughtful. And your mom really was the best cook. Love her recipes. Yeah. And just like you were saying too, like, you know, you have to deal with like all this, all of her stuff and all of her things and really being like intentional about, I remember like us going through after she died, like to her house and kind of, you know, you were looking through stuff and saying like, no, this really reminds me of her. I'm keeping this, I'm keeping that, or even like, you know, the dresser and stuff like that. So I feel like all those can, like you said, help the person's memory live on.
Totally. And I even just kept random things from her kitchen. So like her potato masher that she had forever and used all the time, you know, it's just, even just using those items in my day-to-day are really helpful and kind of just help keep the memory alive. So highly recommend, you know, keeping even just those random, I have her hairbrush, like just random things and using them in your daily life and all of it helps.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about like the grieving process, which I think like that's what terrifies me. Cause I just feel like I am, yeah, just an emotional like person. And I can't even like, there's no way to even comprehend like what that's like. And I don't even know if that's something that you can even like sum up what that's like, but maybe just like, what has your experience been? And also for those of us like loved ones, friends, and I don't know if it's wrong to put it in your court, but maybe just from like what, like you seeing like this absolutely doesn't help and this is helpful. Like what are things that people can do to best support a grieving person?
Yeah, grief is tough. I kind of think we're all experiencing a collective grief right now with the coronavirus situation. For me, due to the nature of my mom's illness, I experienced a lot of anticipatory grief. So while she was dying, I just was kind of in that space and I was anxious. I wasn't able to focus. I was confused. I had a short fuse. I probably was really rude to a lot of people. I didn't know what her death was going to be like and I didn't know when it was going to happen. So that's what it was like, you know, in the time leading up to her death. And then after she died, I think I was just so focused on the physical loss of her. And I spent a lot of time at her house with her things. I put her clothes on. I was just so sad. You know, I can't describe the feeling. I've learned to lean into it, as they say, and I don't avoid it anymore. And there's this analogy I think I shared with you just a while ago about this ball in a box. People have probably heard of this, but it's like there's a box with a ball in it, and on the wall of the box, there's a pain button. And like in the beginning, you know, when you're first experiencing grief, the ball is huge and you can't move this box without the ball hitting that pain button. And it just rattles around in the box and it keeps hitting the button over and over again, and you can't control it, and it happens at random times. But over time, like now, I'd say like for me, my ball in the box is a lot smaller and it hits that button less. But when it does, you know, you can't control how you feel, and the pain is not any less. It's just less frequent. Mm. So I feel like I function a lot better on the day-to-day now, but, you know, random times or random things will happen, and, you know, you just kind of give into it and let it splash over you and just let it all go. But I feel like lately I've been dealing with a new level of grief where I'm experiencing good things and happy moments, and I don't have this person who I shared my entire life with to experience those wins with and those positive experiences. And that is just as difficult as all of the sadness. And I wasn't expecting that. And I had just been in my sadness space for so long that I forgot what it was like to experience goodness. And it was also just as sad because I couldn't share it with my mom. So it's an ongoing process. That's kind of what my experience has been like.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And also, it's different for everyone. I think that what you just said, it really speaks to the complexity of it all, where, you know, it can come in waves, and you just don't know how you're going to feel, you know, when it happens to you and when you're going through that. But having conversations like this is so helpful. Like, even for me, as you're talking, I'm like, okay, these are all things that I definitely haven't thought about. I think for a lot of people, they kind of just push it to the side because it's very sad or depressing, or it can be very anxiety inducing. But it's important to like really talk about what this might look like for someone, what grief might look like for you, what having to, you know, sort through all of the practical things when a really close person passes, like what that looks like as well. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your experience and sharing all of these resources. This has been so, so helpful.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad we were able to have this discussion, and hopefully it motivates more people to talk about death. It's really a part of life and it can be a positive experience.
I feel like it's going to help so many people. And then also just the collective. I don't think I've ever in my lifetime experienced this much collective anxiety about something like COVID-19, and just seeing, you know, like I've friends whose parents have it. And then like my dad's terrified of leaving the house, and just having to think about all these things and what is inevitable for all of us is death. So just having a conversation has been so helpful, and I've been like really moved. So thank you so much. Thank you guys for tuning into another episode of the Food Heaven podcast. We hope you guys enjoyed this vulnerable conversation as much as we did. And we are so grateful to Ashley for sharing all of this information. If you enjoyed this podcast, do us a huge favor and please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast online, especially if you guys are iTunes users. And do us a favor and spread the knowledge. Share this with a friend who might find it beneficial.
Yep. And you can also connect with us online. We're most active on Instagram at Food Heaven. On the Food Heaven podcast, we talk to different health and nutrition experts about how we can live healthier, more balanced lives. Each week, we dive into topics like health at every size, food culture, intuitive eating, mental health, and body acceptance. Our podcast is released every Wednesday, and each week, we take a deep dive into topics like health at every size, food and culture, intuitive eating, mental health, and body acceptance. If you're looking for a sustainable and inclusive path to wellness, come hang out with us and learn how to take care of yourself from the inside out. We'll catch you next time. Bye.